I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. Kansas is surrounded on three sides by states with legalized medical marijuana. So are attitudes about pot changing there? And if they are, is a legal pot option soon to come? Today, why Kansas law enforcement is against medical marijuana and how it's making its case. We'll also check in on the first year's harvest of marijuana's non-psychoactive cousin, hemp, in Kansas. Then, as society's acceptance of gender nonconforming identities ebbs and flows, more folks with those identities are undergoing gender confirmation surgery. We'll dive into the latest thinking on that with family psychologist Wes Crenshaw. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. Are attitudes in Kansas changing when it comes to legalizing marijuana or even medicinal marijuana? That's hard to say, although we do know that Kansas is now surrounded on three sides by states with legal medical marijuana. There are Oklahoma, Missouri, and Colorado. And in Colorado, of course, recreational use is now legal for adults. Kansas remains just one of get this, four states in the country without a comprehensive medical or recreational marijuana program. Does that mean that medical pot is coming soon to the Sunflower State? Not necessarily, says the Kansas News Service's Nomeen Ujiadeen, who has reported on a group of people who are somewhat predictably against the move. That's law enforcement. Nomeen Ujiadeen is a reporter with the Kansas News Service, and for once, she joins me here in the studio. Nice to have you.
It's nice to be Welcome. Here, Steve.
When it comes to marijuana, Kansas is, as I mentioned, increasingly becoming an island. Tell us about that.
So as you mentioned, Kansas is now surrounded on all three sides by states that have legalized some form of marijuana, be it recreational or medical. And one big reason that Kansas has been so conservative on the issue is that law enforcement opposes the legalization. They're probably the biggest group that opposes any movement on that issue.
I'm wondering, before we go on, what are the other states that don't have any public cannabis access program, whether it's recreational or medicinal? What are the other states?
So there's Idaho, Nebraska, South Dakota, and us, Kansas.
Just us. Okay. Yeah. So law enforcement is against this. There have been this ongoing push to pass medical marijuana legislation, 18 bills introduced in Kansas since 2006, but nothing's really moving. Why does law enforcement remain so adamantly opposed?
The biggest reason is public safety. So law enforcement testified at a medical marijuana bill that was in front of the state legislature earlier this year. And the biggest reasons they cited were concerns about increased crime, increased car accidents, and increased access to children.
Have those problems cropped up in other states? Do you have any broad sense of that?
For the reporting that I did, I didn't look at other states so much. I mostly focused on Kansas.
Yeah. You know, law enforcement also maintains that weed is inherently tied to violence, as you just said. I mean, how so? What do they say about that?
So they argued that legalization of even medical marijuana could increase activity by drug cartels, especially Latin American and Mexican drug cartels. They also say that it could result in increased car accidents due to impaired driving. However, in my reporting, I tried to talk to the Kansas Bureau of Investigation, which is the top law enforcement mm-hmm. agency in the state, about just Mexican drug cartel activity in the state, and they didn't provide any interviews on that. As far as I can tell, there isn't really any accounting for which drugs in Kansas actually come from cartels versus which ones come from domestic sources or in-state sources.
I was going to say, you went out searching for data that would look at all of this, but you found out the state doesn't collect much data, and I'm wondering, why is that?
So the KBI, Kansas Bureau of Investigation, told me that The computer system that they use to collect crime and arrest data in the state is currently being updated, and it currently doesn't collect any information on the amount of marijuana seized or how many people are arrested for marijuana-related crimes. And so they said that they're in the process of a multi-million dollar revamp of the system, and once that's over, that should address that issue. But the arrest reports that law enforcement agencies use across the state actually don't specify which drugs are seized or which drug-related crimes that people are charged with when they arrest people or confiscate items.
There was one stat that was interesting to me that you had in your story. The Highway Patrol has noticed an increase in the number of drivers impaired by marijuana. The Highway Patrol said 62% of lab tests of impaired drivers in 2018 came back positive for THC. Just 2 years earlier, the number was just 54% of labs found traces of the drug. What's the patrol's theory about what's going on here?
Sure. So aside from the data on that, I did talk to some officers who said that in the officers' personal anecdotal experience, they were stopping more people who were impaired due to marijuana. And they think that's because, number one, there have been changing societal attitudes toward marijuana. People are just more relaxed about it now. And also because marijuana was legalized recreationally in Colorado.
And that's made a difference, too, it sounds like. You know, others say, and this was also interesting, that law enforcement might have an ulterior motive here for wanting to keep marijuana illegal. What's the thinking there from folks like State Senator David Haley?
So I spoke to Senator Haley, and he said that law enforcement does have an incentive to keep it illegal because they have an incentive to maintain the status quo. There are other people who are pro-legalization who argue that law enforcement has always been conservative on the issue. They'll stay conservative on the issue, and that's just the way it is, and so they like to keep things that way.
Okay. A lot of officers think the state's marijuana laws are outdated and archaic. Do they think that attitude is here to stay?
Yeah, there definitely are law enforcement officers who sort of break away from that status quo. I spoke to someone who's a defense attorney. He defends people on DUI charges and driving under the influence of drug charges. And he said that he regularly speaks to police officers who think that our current marijuana enforcement is unproductive because it leads to a lot of people going to prison. And also, he said that a lot of these younger officers have also grown up around the drug, and so they're a little more comfortable with it. I don't know whether those attitudes are here to stay or whether they're changing.
Right.
From the sources that I spoke to, they say that not every law enforcement officer in the state of Kansas believes the same thing.
I was going to say the attitudes of the Highway Patrol seem to be reflective in society. Some thinking that as older Highway Patrol officers retire, maybe attitudes will change in law enforcement as well.
Sure. Yeah, that's possible.
Yeah. Any sense that the 2020 session is going to result in big changes to marijuana laws here?
It's really hard to tell. This year, that medical marijuana bill that I mentioned got a really big hearing, and there were a lot of people who showed up to testify for that and who also submitted written testimony. So you can definitely tell that the people of Kansas are really invested in this issue. However, that bill didn't make it to a floor vote, which means that the people in the committee that were first considering the bill didn't think it was important enough to go to the full legislature.
Or the votes weren't there.
Right. Yeah. Or that they didn't support the bill for whatever reason. So some people see that committee hearing as a sign of progress, and they think there might be another one next year. Other people I've spoken to, I've spoken to some CBD shop owners who are just completely pessimistic about it, and they don't think Kansas will ever change. And the other thing is that Kansas as a state does not allow ballot referendums. And so that's one way that a lot of other states have legalized marijuana.
Like Missouri.
Yeah, exactly. Or like Oklahoma. But since Kansas doesn't have that, it has to go through the legislature. So it all kind of relies on that.
Okay. That's Nomeen Ujia Dean. She's with the Kansas News Service. Thanks for your reporting. Thanks for coming in.
Yeah, thank you, Steve.
Well, speaking of cannabis, this is the first year that farmers in Kansas have been able to cultivate marijuana's non-psychedelic cousin, that's hemp. Hemp can be turned into a natural fiber, and it's good for making everything from, you know, from diapers and denim to soaps and something called hemp seed oil. Some farmers growing it, though, are up against a formidable and familiar opponent. That's Mother Nature. Kansas News Service reporter Brian Grimmett has reported on the rollout of industrial hemp in Kansas. He joins us now from KMUW in Wichita. Brian, nice to have you. Good morning.
Yeah, good morning.
First off, what is hemp, or industrial hemp as it's sometimes referred to? What are we talking about here? Because this is not marijuana.
Yeah, it's not marijuana, but it can be a little confusing because it is the same plant. So it's the sciencey term is cannabis sativa. Uh-huh. But the difference between they look the same, they are the same, but the difference between what would be considered marijuana and what is classified as industrial hemp is the THC level. And in many states, I don't know if it's all of them, but in many states, and including here in Kansas, that THC level has to be below 0.3% when they harvest it.
Okay. Well, the hemp industry, meantime, in Kansas, as I mentioned, is off to a rough start. What's going on that front, Brian?
Yeah, so this is the first year of the industrial hemp pilot program. And what this was after the legislature passed a bill in 2018, the Kansas Department of Agriculture worked very quickly, I might say, to get in place rules that allowed farmers to try out industrial hemp. But in order to do that, they had to submit an application, and there had to be some kind of research component to it. So the universities are getting involved, as well as just regular farmers. And so this year, come June, starting in February and March, they started issuing the first permits, allowing people to do this. And then, you know, March, April, May and June come around, and that's when typically you start planting hemp. Farmers, those who got the licenses, you know, had the same problem that everybody, all the other farmers had, is that they couldn't really get into the fields because of how wet it was.
Hmm. I was going to say, you talked to a grower named PJ Sneed who planted, I think it was an acre and a half of hemp, but immediately ran into trouble. What happened to him?
Yeah, so he planted on the first day. They got an acre and a half out, and then a big storm moved through. He's in Reno County, and a big storm moved through, and it knocked over all of the plants. So he had to go back out and by hand pretty much put all the plants back into the ground to make sure that they would keep growing.
You know, lawmakers last year approved this pilot program for growing industrial hemp. Describe that program for us a little more here, because maybe you could classify it as a tentative step the state is taking here, Brian.
Yeah, it's definitely a tentative step. And when they were going through the process of creating the program, they held lots of hearings. They talked to officials of the Kansas Department of Agriculture, talked to officials in Kentucky and Colorado and other states, but those two a lot, because those states already have kind of established industrial hemp programs to learn about it. But this program now, like I said a little bit earlier, it's research-based. Everybody who's a part of it has to has to have some kind of research project behind it. They are filing reports to the Department of Agriculture of when they plant, how much they plant, what type they plant, the seed. And then at the end of the year when they harvest, all of that information is also going to go to the Kansas Department of Agriculture. And ultimately, there's going to be kind of this yearly report saying, here's what we did, here's what happened, and here are some of the results.
Well, there's already this concern that because the ground has been so wet that the results this year might not be all that helpful.
Yeah, there's a little bit of concern that maybe there's going to be some skewed results. There is a little bit of optimism because especially those who chose, there's several different ways you can plant hemp. Some people are doing it through something called clones, which is basically like a growing plant already that you put in the ground. Some people are actually growing hemp using hydroponics and in greenhouses. So the weather hasn't impacted them at all. And I spoke to one person who wasn't in my story, but I spoke to another person after the fact that said, they're getting ready to harvest in the next, you know, couple weeks because they grow in a greenhouse and the weather hasn't been a problem at all. And then there are those who plant just seed and their plant dates were a little bit later. And so they still might be able to be fine as long as the weather doesn't get too wet again. They might still get pretty good results from their studies.
So how many acres have been planted just roughly across the state of Kansas?
Yeah, so it's interesting to look at this in a couple different ways. So the Kansas Department of Agriculture approved 5,200 acres in 71 counties. So that seems like a whole lot. But as of July 1st, only 680 acres of hemp had been planted. And a lot of that was weather-related, and they do expect that number to go up pretty significantly, but they don't expect... And you see this in other states as well. Even though they've approved 5,200 acres, they do not expect that many to be actually planted.
And how were the farmers selected, Brian, who are actually out there growing? Because as you pointed out, not everybody who wanted to take part has been allowed to.
Yeah, so if you wanted to take a part of the program, you had to fill out an application, and as well as the application, there's a federal background check that has to happen. It's a pretty extensive, actually, that goes into it. The state received 392 applications, and they've issued so far 248 of those. So like you said, not everybody got a license. And what they were looking for was somebody who... was able to do it, had some things kind of set up and prepared, as well as had something they were looking at. You know, I'm going to test this variety of hemp, or I'm going to test, you know, how does this help regenerative agriculture practices? Like, if I use hemp as a cover crop, is that going to help, you know, my other crops, that kind of thing?
I was going to say, is there a market for this stuff?
That's the big question. The biggest market right now, and it's kind of shifted, there are a couple different things you can get from a hemp plant. You can use it for its fiber, so it'll grow kind of like this big stalk if you do that kind of variety, and that can be used for all sorts of stuff, from clothes to rope to hemp concrete, actually. But then there's also, and so that's one market that's kind of really small at this point.
You said hemp concrete?
Yes, hempcrete, hemp concrete. It's a building material that people are working on that is hemp based. It's pretty interesting.
I just learned something new, Brian. Yeah.
So that's one part, and that's a small part, and really the machines to process the fiber are few and far between, at least in the United States at this point, and expensive. So that's a limit on that market. But the bigger market and kind of the exploding market is more of the like. The CBD oil based kind of product. So things that you would put not in food necessarily, because the FDA hasn't approved that yet, but the creams, the oils, the health kind of adjacent products.
So these hemp growers can actually contribute to that CBD industry, it sounds like you're saying?
Yeah, and it's the CBD without the THC, and that's
right.
That's where it comes from, is these industrial hemp plants. And a lot of the people I spoke to, at least in Kansas, and not that there are people doing everything, but a lot of the ones I spoke to here and even in other states, that CBD oil, which you get from the seeds and from the floral material of the plant, that's kind of the bigger market there. And how big that can be, you know, some experts say in the United States this is a, you know, couple billion dollar industry, but at this point it's kind of guesses.
Yeah. You know, I was struck by a photo that accompanied your story on all of this that showed a sign in PJ Sneed's field proclaiming in big letters, "This is not marijuana." Why the sign?
Yeah, I actually had the same question when I pulled up to his farm for the first time. I saw that sign. It's big, right out on the corner of the road where his field is. And I was like, oh, that's an interesting sign. So I asked him about it, and he told me that's actually required. That is a part of the license, is that you have to label your field to say this is not marijuana. It has your license number on it, on the sign, as well as a number to the Kansas Department of Agriculture, so people can check. And I think the reason behind that is because it is indistinguishable from the marijuana plants. It's the same thing, just bred without the THC. And so it's to kind of ease fears of law enforcement and the community to say, nope, this is a legit program run by the state. Everything is kosher.
Well, it's going to be fascinating to see where this goes in Kansas. Now, as I pointed out earlier, Kansas just one of four states nationwide without any kind of medicinal or recreational marijuana program. The state did pass a bill allowing patients and caregivers to possess CBD oil. Hemp is being grown in the state now. I mean, it just is interesting to me. We're sort of moving toward a certain goal line here, but not crossing it yet, like so so many other states, you can't help but wonder how much longer it's going to be.
Yeah, and it's interesting because some states have been able to draw a clear distinction between hemp and the medical marijuana and even recreational marijuana. And that's kind of a – and it's different each state, but that can be a really hard barrier. And I think in Kansas right now, at least on the hemp side, they're looking at this as a viable alternative crop. I mean, with some of the farmers struggling out there with corn and soybean prices and with the tariff stuff, they're looking at hemp as possibly this alternative that could make some money. And so from the Kansas Department of Agriculture's perspective, that's what they're looking at this as. This is an alternative crop, and we want to see if it's viable for our state and for our economy.
That's reporter Brian Grimmett with the Kansas News Service. He joined us from the studios of KMUW down in Wichita. Brian, thanks so much for the update. I sure appreciate it.
Yeah, you're welcome. Thanks for having me.
Stay with us. We'll meet a young man who has undergone surgery so his physical self matches his emotional and psychological gender. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to KCUR 89.3. And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. Friday on the show, how definitions of patriotism have evolved since the American Revolution. You can hear that conversation and other previous episodes. Just go to kcur.org/up-to-date. Later this week on the show, now that the Plaza's Cinemark Theater is closed, Kansas City teens are left without a summer hotspot. We'll ask a councilwoman and teenager where young people can now go to just hang out. That's later on this week on KCUR's Up to Date. Well, the movement toward greater acceptance of gender nonconforming identity seems to, you know, lurch forward and fall back both socially and politically. But from the psychological and medical side of it, there's been a surge recently in favor of those wishing to transition to better fits physically with the gender they experience emotionally and psychologically. For some people, this idea makes perfect sense. Others find the whole thing perplexing and strange. That's why we're delving into the latest thinking in gender identity and just how much has changed since we did a show on this topic back in 2013. With us to help us along the way is Wes Crenshaw. He's a family psychologist and certified sex therapist in Lawrence. He and his colleagues have extensive experience working with teens and young adults with diverse gender identities who are at different stages of transition. Wes, welcome back. Always good to have you here.
Nice to be here, Steve.
We're also joined by Peter. Peter is a trans man in his 20s who's worked with Dr. Wes for the last 8 years, from the coming out process to a recent gender confirming surgery to preserve Peter's identity. We're not using his real name here today. Peter, welcome. Nice to have you here.
Hi, nice to be here.
So, Peter, please bear with us, you know, with those of us who are still, even after the last 6 or 7 years, trying to reconcile ourselves to the differences between gender and physical sex differences. Can you explain it to us as you did your family and friends?
Well, I'm going to be honest that it's actually a lot more difficult to explain now than it was several years ago.
Why?
Because there have been a lot more terminology that has become a lot more frequently used.
It's hard for people to hang on to all that stuff.
Trust, it's hard for it me is. Too as well oh, sometimes.
I'm glad to hear that, actually.
Yeah. All of us.
Yeah.
And I just want to preface that not everybody may agree with the things that I'm saying. This is just from my perspective.
Sure.
Other people may have different ideas. But generally, when you're born, you're assigned a sex at birth, which is most of the time male or female. There are people who are intersex, but I'm not going to get into that at this point.
Mm-hmm.
And then as you get older, you begin to figure out sort of where your gender is. And gender as a whole is very much a spectrum. You have on one side people who very much identify as female. You have people on the other side that very much identify as male. Then you have this gray area in between where you have people who may identify as both. You may switch. You may not identify with any of them. It's a very individual process, and kind of figuring that out is the hard part.
And for a lot of young people, I mean, it's really hard because when I was growing up, that wasn't a question I faced. Young people these days are having to face it, right?
Definitely. And even, I mean, I'm not that old, but even when I was growing up, it wasn't really something I had that much of an idea with. There was male, female, and trans. And
yeah.
Now, even more, there's more identities people can feel comfortable with, which is great. Because I definitely think my process would have been a lot different had I known more options existed at that time.
You know, Dr. West, as Peter just pointed out, this process has come on society pretty quickly here. I think a lot of people out there are sort of reeling over all this, trying to grapple with what this means, what it suggests, and everything else.
Yeah. That Sacha Baron Cohen's show, I think it's called This Is America. He has one of his characters on there is this very liberal, like Portland kind of person who identifies 26 genders. And that's said as a joke, but it is reflecting mm-hmm. that sort of parody of what we're all going through at this time. And I'm not going to say it isn't complicated, but it's probably not as complicated as we make it sometimes. What is happening is, and a key question people always have with everything, you know, where'd all these ADD people come from? Where did all these autistic people, where'd all these transgender people come from? Mm-hmm. And the answer for all those questions is the same. We are recognizing them more. We are inviting them to say, this is who I am in our society. And that has changed over the years quite a bit.
Peter, how helpful is it what Dr. West just said, this notion that we are recognizing now and a portion of society is really open to recognizing so many different possibilities out there?
Even in my own personal story, when I was trying to come to terms with my identity, I didn't really think that I was allowed to be trans until I met another trans person who was alive, basically.
I'm not alone in the world is sort of your story.
Yeah.
Which is a story so many people face in whatever version of themselves it is.
Yeah. Especially when I was growing up, it's still sort of the same now, but a little bit less so. The only stories that I had about being trans were, I came out as trans and now I don't have a home and all my friends and my family abandoned me, mm-hmm. or I came out as trans and now I am dead.
Mm-hmm. And this is terribly important. There are so many different stories. The one we hear the most about in the media is that one that Peter just described as, you know, the suicide rate being high amongst trans folks and even gay and lesbian folks, and people being disowned and kicked out on the street. So much so has this become the narrative that one of the parents' reactions we will get is, oh my gosh, my child's going to be ostracized. And so being able to say to parents, probably not mm-hmm. in our society today, that doesn't mean there aren't still those kind of terrible incidents of bullying or extracting the person mm-hmm. from their social group. But in general, parents don't need to panic if their child is trans. It may well not be as difficult as they think.
And just so everyone's on the same page here, Dr. West, trans means what?
Okay, so transgender means one is really going to identify with the opposite gender. It's kind of a binary concept. If I am born assigned female, but I come to understand myself more as male and to identify with that gender, mm-hmm. then I would and I pursue that, then I am transgender. Mm-hmm. Gender nonconforming is the person who identifies with neither pole, mm-hmm. male or female.
There's somewhere else on the spectrum that Peter was laying out to us here.
Peter uses he and him pronouns. Gender nonconforming people will use they and their.
Mm-hmm. You know, Peter, this notion you mentioned a minute ago about meeting someone else who was trans for the first time, I'm wondering, what was that moment like for you? And I'm just thinking about something else Wes said about the high suicide rate here, which undoubtedly at least is partly due to the fact that folks who are trans or are somewhere on the spectrum are thinking, I'm alone in the world, I'm confused, I'm lost, I can't relate to anybody. And then they begin thinking suicidal thoughts.
Well, the funny part about me and that individual's meeting was we met in high school and he gave me his link to his Tumblr blog, which is a social media platform. And I went and I looked at it and it had a completely different name, completely different pronouns. I didn't understand what was going on. And I thought someone had stolen his identity. So I then confronted him the next day and he's like, no, wait, I'm actually trans. And I was like, wait, what?
Huh.
And it's been a very mutually beneficial friendship for the both of us, where me completely just not even blinking at him being trans really confirmed his coming out, and him being trans and alive in front of me confirm that that was something that I can do, and we still are incredibly close today.
But you're no stranger to those feelings of self-harm.
Yeah.
You want to describe that?
Well, it's been an interesting process to just go into that as a whole. I've had to really kind of reevaluate it as of recently. As was mentioned, I just recently underwent gender reassignment surgery. And for most of my life, as a whole, like basically from when I was a teenager, I started puberty, I wanted to kill myself. I didn't know why. I just knew I was miserable and it wasn't getting better. I've been in therapy since I was 13 on antidepressants pretty quick after that. And that's been 10, 11 years of my life that is just a constant in the back of my head, what if you killed yourself? And I've been able to navigate it. It's been fine. It's exhausting. But then about a week or two after I had surgery, when I was kind of starting to come off of a lot of the medications and kind of start moving around again, that started kind of coming back, the what if you killed yourself? And for the first time that I can remember, I stopped and I went, no, I don't want to die anymore. And I've been trying to like figure out like, oh my God, I thought I wasn't going to make it to my adult life. And now I want to live. For the first time in my life, I want to live. And that's been awesome, but scary.
This is where the value of the reassignment surgery comes in. One can do therapy with Peter till the cows come home. And if you don't address that gender dysphoria, you're not going to ever make the change that Peter described.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with a young man, Peter, who has undergone surgery so his physical self matches his emotional and psychological gender. We're visiting with Dr. Wes Crenshaw as well. If you want to join our conversation with questions, 816-235-2888 is our phone number here, or you can tweet us at KCUR up to date. You know, Peter, it might be a good time for you to share your story with us and take us back to the beginning, I mean, and sort of the journey you've been on here a little bit.
All right. That's a lot. I sort of touched on it a bit ago for meeting that individual. And really what kind of got me...
How old were you when you began wondering about yourself and who you were and your own identity?
Honestly, probably the first time I wondered about it but did not realize exactly what I was thinking of was I have two younger brothers. I remember being about 6 or 7 and it was the summer and both of them were allowed to run around without their shirts on. And I was not allowed to do that. And I was very mad about it. And I didn't understand why. And I remember my parents sitting down and being like, it's because you're a girl. You can't do that because you're a girl. And I was like, I don't feel like that. But I didn't have the words to be able to express that. And that sort of continued into adulthood, sort of continued into trying to figure out my sexuality. For a very long time, I thought I was a lesbian. That really didn't work. But I thought that maybe all the feelings that I was having was because I was gay. That really wasn't the thing. And then I met that individual, realized that I could be trans.
You were about 16. Is that right?
Probably.
I think you were, yeah.
I'm really bad at timelines.
You're not good with time. I think that was about age 16. And I met up with Peter. I was one of the first people you talked with this about. And that forms what I describe in my model in the book we're working on as the first conflict. I use a conflict model in working with transgender teens. And the first conflict is the conflict with self, and that's well illustrated. Peter has this experience that doesn't have a language. The language comes along, and then Peter either feels a great sense of relief or more conflict, depending on how he comes out of that. And so for the next months and months and months, that was where Peter was in that conflict with self.
You know, I'm just trying to put myself in your shoes a little bit here. This notion that you went so many years adrift and I'm guessing confused, Peter, about who you were and what you wanted to be and not having the language, as Wes just said. How difficult was that to sort of, during those formative years particularly, which strike me as, you know, so incredibly difficult?
Oh, I was miserable. The whole wanting to kill myself constantly was very, very much a thing in my teenage years.
What kept you from not doing it?
I have a very large guilt complex, and I didn't want other people to have to deal with me being dead.
Hmm. And I think it does bear pointing out, because I think people are familiar with teens and their emotional state and their, you know, a time, they're all going to have some feelings of self-harm at one time or another. Mm-hmm. But that was not the persona Peter put out into the world during that time. Like, that was almost surprising to me when I later realized how intense that sense was. Peter wasn't one of those people who's jumping up, you know, every month and saying, I just want to die. I just want to die. That was a very private experience for him.
Well, because it was one of those things that was just always in the back of my head. It wasn't anything that ever, like, came right to the front, but it was very much like if you're carrying a backpack full of rocks around mm-hmm. forever. So it's there. It's not obtrusive, but it's there.
That's a good analogy. You know. That's the conflict I'm talking about.
I'm guessing talking to mom and dad was difficult, or do you go there with a conversation like that? I'm just sensing from, yeah.
So that's conflict too.
Okay.
The second conflict is conflict with the community and or the family. And historically, and as Peter will talk about in a moment, normally young people have come out to their peers or an online community first, and then perhaps a therapist, and the family has tended to be last. Of late, I have begun to see far more young people coming out to family. The family brings them to therapy to help the family address this, and then the child comes out to the community. In Peter's case, it was a very interesting struggle because Peter was out to community before family.
And I'm going to be honest, I don't remember when I actually came out to my family. We have had this conversation many times, and nobody can really pinpoint when it happened. Mm-hmm. But I remember specifically when I was working this out, because my family was involved in my therapy, telling Wes specifically he could not talk about anything right related to gender with my family. Because I think one of the things that the LGBTQ community really struggles with, especially younger people, you're entirely dependent on your family for everything. Mm-hmm. And the idea that we all kind of have to struggle with is, if I explain who I am, that love, that unconditional love that your parent is supposed to have for you can be conditional. Mm-hmm. And that's something you really have to be like, okay, these people who love me could suddenly stop loving me. And that's a very, very, very difficult thing to get over. And especially in my case, where that ended up being all in my head, mm-hmm. where because all the stories I'd ever seen up until that point had bad outcomes, where I was really adamantly convinced it was going to be a huge problem. And I was so, so, so scared. But then it ended up being completely fine. My family and I have a wonderful relationship.
So you did it the old-fashioned way, right, based on what Wes has said. You came out to community first and then talked to family.
Definitely, yes.
And tell me about that. How did that go for you?
It actually went pretty smoothly. I still have a very accepting group of friends that sort of allowed me to kind of play with my identity a little bit and get comfortable with it. It wasn't anything that was ever so set in stone, especially because there's this group that all the queer people sort of grouped together. Mm-hmm. And so everyone that I was friends with in high school was trying to figure that out. So it wasn't that weird. And the online persona gave me a place to sort of, again, sort of play with it in a safe environment.
Which is very frequent.
Where if I had suddenly been like, actually, I don't like this, I can just delete it and then it goes away.
Well, to have that peer group, Peter, must have been absolutely vital to you during those years.
Definitely.
Yeah, and I'm still buddies with a lot of those folks today.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah.
Roommates with one of them.
Yep.
Yeah, okay. And when you came out to family, can you tell us how that went?
And as I said, I don't exactly remember specifically how that went.
I remember one of the big conflicts was senior prom.
Oh, yeah.
Because by that time, you were wanting to dress in a more, in not a very feminine way, not a real girly way, but in a more feminine way, I think. And your parents were not into that. And I don't remember more details about it, but I know that was a significant part of the conflict.
Yeah, I've forgotten a significant number of these things on purpose. So.
Yeah, I'm sure. Yeah.
Aren't we lucky we have me around?
Yes.
But you do remember, you do as I say that, remember that.
Yeah, no, yeah. I remember that. One of the things I think specifically that details how much my family has come around is my middle brother. We're very close in age, so he had to follow right behind me in high school. Mm-hmm. And he got a lot of flack for for me trying to figure this out, because he was the stereotypical jock football player, and I was me,
right.
which is, but me and him had some of the biggest throwdown fights about my gender, and then when
he was saying what?
I don't remember specifically.
Was he saying, figure it out, kid?
He was basically just telling me to stop because it was affecting his social life, me figuring this out.
He was embarrassed, maybe,
yeah.
that you were...
I think so, and he just really didn't know what to make of it.
Because this is like 8 years ago or so where we were really in a transition to a time when it wasn't... Like, now it's totally not cool to do that for adults or teens.
Not and cool to do what?
To make unkind or disparaging comments about your brother or friend who may be struggling with gender identity.
But the good part about this is after we had both graduated and he went to college, I went to help him move in to his dorm up at KU. And he introduced me as his brother to everyone there. And I think it just really shows how far that they've come. And he was the one that had, I think, the most issue with it. Because it affected him socially. Everyone else was just kind of like, I don't really know what to do about this. Live your dreams, I guess.
But he sounds like he's pretty good today, then.
Yes. All my family is very, very, very wonderfully accepting. They have it took some adjustment, which is completely valid, as I was a girl for like at least 20 years.
Even for me, it took some adjustment.
Yeah.
People may say, well, yeah, because you people live in Lawrence and it's, you know, the People's Republic of Lawrence or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
The reality is I see kids because, you know, we have a pretty big practice at this point. And so I see kids from small towns all over this part of the state. And most of them are having a similar experience. Their parents are now, you know, where the sample skews is, we have parents open enough to say, hey, let's work through this. But there are farmers and there are small town merchants and there are engineers and people of all sorts of different families bringing kids in with these kind of questions and searches.
Matching your physical self with your emotional and psychological gender. That's our conversation here today. Dr. Wes Crenshaw is in the studio. He's joined by Peter. Your questions welcome. 816-235-2888 or tweet us at KCUR UpToDate. You know, Wes, I want to go back to something we talked earlier this segment about, which is the idea of how quickly all this has come upon us. Is it social media? Movements never happened this quickly, you know, years ago. This happened really fast. Why? What's propelling this forward to a point where even in Peter's lifetime, he's seen dramatic change?
Well, so you and I are both political guys. We're interested in politics. And if you take a step back and think about the word movements and how quickly they happen in politics, you probably would change your thought a bit, because look how rapidly certain political movements are happening this year in the elections and so on. It is highly social media related. We've done shows before for years on the internet and the good and the bad of the internet. This is one of the good things. It lets people connect, people who maybe were sitting out in Goodland, Kansas, wondering about gender identity and had no one to speak to about that. There's a cadre of hundreds of thousands of people now they can speak to, some better than others. So that has helped a lot. And we just have a continued march towards individual freedoms for people to be able to say, this is who I am.
You know, Peter, you recently had what's been referred to as top surgery. I think we can generally get the idea of what that is, but do you want to give us an overview?
Well, basically what it was a double mastectomy. So I was born female. And as I hit puberty, I had breasts, and they were terrible. And I wanted them removed basically immediately upon getting them, and did not know why at that point in time. But
just to clarify what terrible means in that sentence, they were wrong for you. You looked at them and you said they do not belong here.
Basically, it is affectionately equated to as basically chest tumors, because they should not have been there. I did not like them, and for probably since I was about 16, I wore what is known as a binder, which was essentially crushing them to my chest. And it was very painful, and you wore it all day, and it made it hard to breathe, basically do anything.
And that's usually the first stage of transition is for male to from female to male is to bind.
Yeah.
And there are ways to do it and ways not to do it. Anybody wanting to do it, read up, do your homework.
Please don't use ace bandage.
Don't use an ace bandage.
This was interesting to me, the medical and health insurance community's reaction, response to your top surgery, Peter. What was the reaction?
As in for the insurance's reaction?
Insurance, yeah. It was covered, right?
It was, yes. And that's an actual
that
new
surprised,
thing.
That surprised me to hear
it,
that.
It surprised
new.
Me, too.
It's new.
For, like, and I've known since I figured out I was trans and even before that that I wanted this procedure done. But it had always been something that was kind of unobtainable just because of the cost.
Mm-hmm.
As it's realistically between $7,000 to $10,000 out of pocket if you're paying for it without insurance. And so it was always something where I was like, oh, I'll get to that someday. It's not a big deal right now because I'm a millennial and I have $3. But
yeah.
But recently my employment, their insurance updated, and it used to specifically say that gender reassignment surgery wasn't covered. And then they took that out. And I realized that, and I immediately started the process.
Wes, what did it take to get to that point? Because, again, this is surprising me a little bit.
Well, you got me. It is – Peter doesn't even really have – we won't say what it is, but Peter doesn't exactly have great health insurance. I take his health insurance. And it's
so
not
you know
it's
about
not
this,
that
yeah.
great. And so when he first came back to me, because we've been on and off over the years, as Peter's need help, he comes in, we talk. And he said, hey, you know, I'm headed towards surgery. And he said, I think maybe insurance is going to pay for it. I said, I'll believe it when I see it.
Mm.
And we had to do pre-auths. We had to write letters. There are letters that must be written anyhow. The fourth conflict is always between the therapist and the client, because in this weird role, no other place is this true. The therapist is not an evaluator normally. In this case, they are. And I have to be able to write a letter that says two things. Peter really does live what's called the true life. He really is living in the gender he experiences psychologically.
You had to confirm that
I have
for the insurance
confirm
company.
That. Mm-hmm. And for that and for the surgeon. And then I also have to state that Peter's sufficiently mentally healthy. Isn't it good to know that, Peter? You're
yeah.
sufficiently mentally healthy so that he is able to make that decision without impairment. And that allowed what's called medical necessity for his insurance, and they then covered it. And we even were able to get, to my shock and amazement, he also got his company's disability policy to cover his convalescence. Huh. So this is one of the reasons we wanted to do this show now, is we're on the cutting edge here. Peter is the only person, the first person who has been able to do that I've worked with.
However,
just quickly, Peter, it's got a few seconds left.
So the interesting thing about the disability going in was the disability covered it. I had to get FMLA, which was leave, through a different company. They didn't think it was medically necessary,
wow.
but everybody else did, and so it was fine. But I was just like, okay, one random thing. But
we're going to have to leave it.
World.
Yeah. Leave it right there. Peter, thanks for sharing your story with us. I appreciate it. Dr. Wes Crenshaw, family psychologist, certified sex therapist over in Lawrence. Dr. Wes, great to have you here.
Good to be here.
On Wednesday, we remember Emmett Till, a brutally murdered black teenager whose death changed the Mississippi Delta and the nation. Our show is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Elizabeth Ruiz, and Emily Aiken. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.